Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle's weekly design show with me, Hugo MacDonald. This week's episode, we hopped across the channel to Holland, a small country that packs a punch in the world of design. Coming up on the show, we hear from head of the Man and Wellbeing Department at Design Academy Eindhoven, Ilse Crawford.
There's the insight to use design, basically, to build a new future.
We find out why Amsterdam is the new global hotspot for the advertising industry.
You know, we have about 125 employees here from about 25 different countries, so we sort of have a miniature version of Earth.
And we hear how Dutch mid-century design is making a comeback in the collector's market.
The hope for a piece like that would be that it becomes an absolute classic key piece of this period of Dutch design, and therefore would tremendously increase in value.
All that, plus we hear from four graduates of Design Academy Eindhoven, we take a look at how Dutch graphic design has impacted our lives, and we visit the studio of a former Eindhoven graduate who's fast becoming a star on the global design circuit. That's all to come on this week's Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. Stay tuned. Welcome to Section D here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. D stands for Dutch this week, as we celebrate all things design from the Netherlands. And who better to kick things off with than a familiar voice here on Monocle 24, Ilse Crawford. Ilse is the founding head of the Man and Wellbeing Department at Design Academy Eindhoven, and she's been responsible for shaping the school's extraordinary output over the last decade. I sat down with her in her London studio to hear why Design Academy Eindhoven is such an important institution.
I have been involved with Design Academy Eindhoven for just over 10 years, and I was asked to be head of a new department called Man and Wellbeing, to start that department, which I have run for the last 10 years, and which is based on the idea of bringing together the way that things look with the way that they connect with us on a human level, so the way that they touch us physically, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, and can change the way we behave and feel. And in addition to that role, also for the last two odd years, I've been curator of the school. So that has meant basically working on the vision of the school and how that is expressed through its publications and through the graduation show and the show in Milan. So I've done four. And I'm about to start on my fifth, the graduation show and the show in Milan.
Congratulations. But also, congratulations, because this is, you've just had the graduation show, and it was a phenomenal success in terms of visitor numbers and the reception of the projects of the students. And we're sitting with this publication, and looking through it, you can't fail but be touched by the individual projects of the students, but also the way that they think and the final products, which, you know, with very little thought, you can see have a very real place in today's world. Is it something that you try and cultivate actively to help the students to think of sort of things that are missing?
I think there's a fundamental thing in Dutch society which is very interesting, which is this great faith in the authentic, autonomous individual as the ultimate solution to problems, that the individual with integrity and intensity can solve many things. And that's certainly at the root of the Design Academy. So the first thing we do as heads, as teachers, is to work out what makes the individual student tick, to work out what their obsessions are, what moves them, and to really sort of then coach them really in how to translate that into experience, a product, a design, but also expose them and challenge them and confront, which is a rather wonderful Dutch word, them with what's going on in the rest of the world. This year's graduation had projects, for example, with Biesbosch, which is a park which I think a lot of students came up with projects for, creative projects really, to show how design can reconnect the public to the idea of natural resources, but in a really fresh way. But in general, I would say that partly it's the Dutch, but partly it's Eindhoven. There is a creative approach to daily life. So, for example, this year's show was our way, 173 graduate projects that have a firm connection with life and a desire to make sense of it. And that pretty much sums it up.
And do you notice that, sort of talking about Dutch design in general, that people are, suddenly there's a bit of a spotlight being turned on the Netherlands for whatever reason, maybe that's after sort of craft of Scandinavia and sort of simple living, lasting design and the sort of intricacies of Italian design, that actually maybe people are beginning to look to the Netherlands and think actually these sort of ideas-driven, human-driven design that I associate with Dutch design maybe has the answers actually for a far wider range of things than just how to furnish a home.
The Dutch have always been quite good at that. I mean, if you look back at the amazing paintings of, you know, the 16th, 17th century, if you look at the huge wealth, actually, that they made during the 16th, 17th, 18th century, I mean, they're very good at money, but they're also very good at everyday life and have had a huge influence in that constantly, really. I mean, there's so much of what we have comes from them. The other interesting thing about Holland, I think, is that, you know, while like everywhere, you know, the culture budgets are being slashed and so on, their reaction to that is quite different to the Brits. So, for example, Eindhoven is a city that has lost a lot of its industry, you know, like everywhere else, it's gone to China, leaving lots of empty space. And the municipality's answer to that is to give a lot of it to designers. So people like Nacho Carbonell, who's actually from Barcelona, has stayed in Eindhoven. Piet Hein Eyck has got a huge factory which he's turned into a shop and atelier for other designers and is really building a sort of community around that space. So there's the insight to use design, basically, to build a new future.
That was Ilse Crawford, head of the Man and Wellbeing Department at Design Academy Eindhoven. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. After hearing about the Design Academy Eindhoven from Ilse Crawford, we thought it made sense to quiz some of the more enterprising students about their graduate projects. We dispatched our Amsterdam reporter, Emil Elgersma, and first up, he met with Akko Goldenbeld to hear some sounds of the city.
It's the city, it's the sound of the city. I'm Akko Goldenbeld. I graduated with city music on the department public space on the Design Academy. I made this device. It's a pianola, actually, like an automatic playing piano. But I made the roll. Normally there's a roll inside the piano and it automatically plays a song. And with my project, I took it outside, like on a big wooden cylinder. And I put a model of Eindhoven on it, a city model. And actually that is what you heard. It's like, yeah, literally the music of the city.
And what is it you wanted to research with this piece?
Actually, I wanted to know how the city sounds like. And in my research, before I did like a different kind of researches, I was busy with collecting sounds, like sounds in the city, but eventually I was like, maybe I have to take it literally. I mean, it's an information layer, the model of a city.
What was the most surprising that you discovered?
Well, the fact that you have like this different dynamics into the city, because you have like the center and it goes a bit to the south, and in the south you have like this, yeah, almost humming kind of sounds, because you have lower buildings and not that much noise, and in the center you have like this loud big buildings, and actually it's like this in reality.
You were studying public spaces. How would you use this pianola in daily life?
Well, it's It's about an idea for architects and also city planners to maybe look at a city this way and listen to a city. When you listen to a city, then you can listen as a composer, and normally you look at it and you see it as a designer. I wanted to suggest that you could also take another layer and maybe solve problems this way. Like, for instance, when you have a loud city, why is it loud? Where does it come from?
That was Monocle reporter Emil L. Gersma with Design Academy Eindhoven student Akko Goldenbeld. Now, emerging design might be making waves in the Netherlands, but that's only half the story. Dutch design from the 1950s and 60s, with its simple lines and solid frames, is growing in popularity with Japanese, American and UK collectors alike. A first-time collection of Dutch designers was recently exhibited at the Rocket Gallery in Shoreditch in London. Our reporter, Amanda Brown, went to the gallery in the T building to find out more.
I'm Jonathan Stevenson, owner of Rocket Gallery. I'm curator of this exhibition, which is called Revolt, Reform, Result. And that title is a reference to three classic pieces of furniture designed by Friso Kramer.
Friso Kramer was one of the big Dutch designers of the 1950s and 60s. His designs were mass manufactured in Holland 60 years ago, but many have since been scrapped, leaving a few pieces that are fast becoming collector's items.
He produced very functional, very sturdy furniture, which obviously lent itself to having a lot of use. And like a lot of the Dutch designers of that period, they were taking advantage of the skills and the factories that they were in Holland, where they were doing excellent metalworking, to a certain extent woodworking, but it was the metalworking that was particularly utilised in a lot of this furniture of this period. So here we have the Result chair, and then we have the Revolt chair. All the same, we should
probably go Dutch. So careful, kid. What stands out as Dutch design straight away to you? What are the elements that stand out?
The Dutch designers of the 50s and 60s were very influenced by the De Stijl movement, which incorporated a lot of the architects, painters and sculptors of the 20s and 30s. And obviously Holland, you think of Mondrian, you think of primary colours, and the Dutch designers of the 50s and 60s carried that on and quite often used primary colours in their work.
This one is in a leather, is it, or a vinyl?
That's a very beautiful leather, actually. This actually came from the home of a Dutch architect in northern Holland, so it was only in one home through its whole life so far.
The leather looks really comfy as well. Where did you come across it, in a home or in a museum?
In Holland, there's a lot of young people who sort of come from sort of art and design backgrounds. Who are also running around the country doing a bit of sort of trading in furniture. And I've managed to link up with quite a few of them in the last couple of years. And they are, you know, very good at sourcing things which, you know, come up at house sales or auctions or whatever.
When you see a piece that's in good condition, what goes through your mind? Do you sort of get quite excited, or are you very calm about it?
I wish I could remain calm, actually. Often you find pieces in the most odd locations in Holland, in very dark settings, and you kind of, you don't want to show too much excitement, but you're sort of, I'm busy sort of looking for the condition, checking all the edges, hoping that the right labels are on the piece, because what's great about a lot of the Dutch companies is they actually put labels on every piece of furniture they produced. And one company, for example, De Cirkel, they actually date stamped every label. So you know exactly if that label is still there on the piece, you know exactly what year that piece was made and even what date it went out of the factory. So those little things are the things that one is like praying to find and hoping when you turn the piece upside down that the label is still there.
This fiberglass.
This orange fiberglass bench by Friso Kramer, who's certainly probably the best known of the Dutch designers of this period. This bench was actually designed in 1968. But it was first had recognition because it was used in the underground station in Munich, the Olympic underground station in 1972. Oddly, though, I did spot a version of it, which was a genuine version, on the internal monorail in this in Stansted Airport the other day. So it was obviously chosen by Norman Foster when he designed the airport.
Again, you can see the functionality of it because it looks comfortable to sit in. One of the features that's recurring around all these seats is that they're surprisingly wide for the 1950s. You think of 1950s things and you think of them as being much smaller, right. And the fact that we've all got much wider now. These would fit us in hopefully in 2030, no right. matter how fat right. we got.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's possibly to do with the size of Dutch people. I think there's the tallest people in the world are come from Northern Holland. So maybe that has a bearing on how the designers worked.
If I bought that lovely big bookshelf I have my eye on for, was it
3,200,
and I put it in my house and reasonably well looked after it, and I thought, well, I need to flog it now in about 5 years. What do you think it might reach?
I mean, that's so hard to say, but I mean, the hope for a piece like that would be that it becomes an absolute classic key piece of this period of Dutch design, and therefore would tremendously increase in value.
Okay, I'm getting my checkbook.
We should probably go Dutch.
That was Monocle reporter Amanda Brown at London's Rocket Gallery. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. We're off back to Eindhoven next for the second of our student check-ins. Stay tuned.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
Welcome back to a very Dutch Section D. Time to hear from a second Design Academy Eindhoven student, Suyin Chon Ahi. Her graduation piece was a short animation movie about the amount of plastic we use in our daily life. Reporter Emil Elgersma watched the movie with Suyin and spoke about her motivation to create the piece.
This is our legacy. We didn't build pyramids or nice Roman churches in this era. The plastic waste is our legacy. My name is Suyin Chon Ahi. I graduated at the Design Academy in Eindhoven in the Department Man and Communication in 2011. And I graduated with a stop motion called A Plastic Life.
When was the moment that you thought, I really have to make an animation about plastic life?
That was actually during the research of the plastic waste problem, because I found it very depressing, all the facts that I found out, because it's actually already way too late to do anything about it. And so it just really got me down. And I thought the only way to communicate this really depressing thought is by means of a very positive and engaging and easy approachable medium, which is animation, I think.
Could you tell us what we see?
You see a sequence of plastic carrier bags from all kinds of decades. And they follow the sequence of a human life. So first you get the bags from when you were a baby. So it's lots of baby diaper bags and things that have to do with products you buy for when you have a baby. And then you get the school campus bags because you go to school, and then you get the high school bags, which is more like popular culture, like your first Levi's and your first Stimmerol bag and so on. And then you get married, so you have bags, you get to see bags which have to do with marriage and building up a family and yeah, et cetera, et cetera. And in the end, you'll see lots of medical bags.
And what is it you want to achieve with this movie?
Well, in the first sense, so this general consciousness that everything in life we do creates waste, creates plastic waste, and that we're stuck with that, and that our future generations are stuck with that. And also, I think, in second place, a way of communicating such depressing things in a more friendly and eye candy way, because I think people are numbed now by all the aggressive environmental infomercials these days.
That was our reporter Emil Elgersma in Eindhoven. Now, back in Amsterdam, it's come to our attention that the Dutch capital is fast becoming the go-to city for advertising agencies in Europe. To find out more, we sent our reporter Louise Stoddard to visit some of the key players and find out why.
In the last 2 to 3 years, the city of Amsterdam has blossomed into a hub for the creative advertising industry. A combination of homegrown talent and heavyweight international agencies have placed this city firmly on the map. Today, I'm hopping on my bike to visit some of the dynamic leaders of the advertising pack. But first, I'm going to stop off at the Business District to meet two women working hard to tempt creatives into the city.
I'm Caroline Gerels. I'm the alderman for economic affairs, for arts and culture, for water management in the city of Amsterdam. It's a city with specific core values, creativity, innovation and spirit of commerce, and that's grown in centuries. For example, during the Golden Age, we had some artists like Rembrandt. They were very creative, very innovative, but they also had a certain spirit of commerce. And that's what you see now in the creative industries. In the 80s and in the 90s, there were the law firms, the banks, and they all went to the southern part where we are now, to the business district, because they grow bigger and bigger. And they are now the clients of that creative companies. We have here, I think, about 20 multinationals. They add a lot of value through their creativity. They find new concepts. The city of Amsterdam is a kind of laboratory, so you can try your concepts, you can prove your concepts, and then they go all over the world.
I'm Hilde Vandermeer, and I'm the director of Amsterdam in Business, which is the official foreign investment agency. So many creative advertising gaming companies have come to Amsterdam. Many times they have 30 nationalities in-house, so they can do worldwide campaigns. So the Nike or the Coca-Cola worldwide campaigns are made here in Amsterdam. For example, American companies that are here, like Wieden and Kennedy, they can't do those campaigns in the US because it's only US or Canadian people that are there.
And it's integrated advertising campaign agency Wieden & Kennedy who are next on my agenda.
I'm Mark Bernath. I am executive creative director at Wieden & Kennedy in Amsterdam. You know, we have about 125 employees here from about 25 different countries, so we sort of have a miniature version of Earth. I think when you have people from all around the world that can bring their own cultural sort of backgrounds, you know, their own references, which are often very different than the ones you might have had, you know, but yet there's something similar about them, you sort of arrive at this universal truth or insight that everybody can agree on. And I'm not sure you can agree on that when everybody's the same, because, you know, you get amazing work when you pit, you know, you put together a German and an Indian, or, you know, a French guy and a, you know, Iraqi, or a, you know, these people find a common ground, and you know if they do that you're probably onto something that everybody in the world might be able to agree with. We tell the story of a couple who are on a first date. It begins with them sort of entering the back of a restaurant. He basically does a series of different behaviors that establish him as quite the legend. First thing he does is brandish one of the knives in the kitchen and expertly slice a potato halfway across the room into a bowl. He takes the woman into the main restaurant, saving her from being run over by a half-eaten duck that's coming through the door on a tray. Then he has sort of a moment of awkwardness, which we always try to have so that he's not completely perfect. So he actually falls down the stairs, only to sort of save the situation by scaring some eels in a tank and making them do this sort of remarkable swim. The club is very sort of Asian influenced and feels like it could be anywhere in the world, but has a very eclectic crowd. And he wheels her into a table just as the Heineken arrives, and the singer sort of breaks back into the song Jan Pehechanho. It's a legendary first date, and I think we imagine that they'll have another one.
I'm Lee Newman. I'm the managing director of Wieden & Kennedy Amsterdam. I generally feel like the more creative agencies that pop up along the canals and here in Amsterdam, the better overall. I think we all benefit from a vibrant creative community, and we've got that. And it does go through some ups and downs. And lately there seems to be, there seems to be a real up going on in Amsterdam, which is nice for all of us. In a way, I think it's a well-kept secret that's slowly getting out.
Next up, it's OKQA, an international agency based just one canal over, where I'm meeting Executive Creative Director Nick Bailey.
Amsterdam's a real village, and it's really unusual. In fact, I don't think there's any other city like it that's so small and yet has such a huge community of creative people, a huge number of big international agencies. So it's like a New York or a London in terms of the number and scale of agencies that are here. But the city itself is tiny, it's a village. So we do all know each other, we do all see each other around, and that does lead to a slightly friendlier, I think, culture and atmosphere among the agencies here. We created a piece of work for Johnny Walker called the Keep Walking Project. So we created an iPhone app which counts your steps as you walk. Johnny Walker's tagline is Keep Walking. So we created an iPhone app and also a Facebook application which counts steps through your engagement in a campaign. So if you share content with your friends, you gain steps. If you invite your friends into the campaign, you gain steps as well. And we built a whole platform that allows those steps to be calculated and shared between friends.
My last stop for the day is just a few doors down at Amsterdam Worldwide, who describe themselves as creative entrepreneurs. I'm meeting up with Brian Elliott. He's the agency head.
What always amazes me is how much we take for granted today. 2 or 3 years ago, we could not do the things we are doing right now. Creating content in China, in Indonesia, putting it together, working at it. We didn't have offices in those places. We just put it together at a distance. And now it's possible to do at reasonable cost. A good example of the kind of work we do is a global campaign we've done with Intel, who make all those lovely computer chips that go inside, well, most everything these days. And we shot, as part of that, a series of short films that are explorations of how interesting people have taken advantage of technology. There's no logos and computers hanging about. It's just about making technology sing. The most recent version of this was we did 2 films in Indonesia. We chose a really great group of young hip-hop artists who, if you close your eyes, you'd think, you know, you're on the streets of a big Western city, but actually they're from Yogyakarta in Indonesia. And what they do is they mix traditional Indonesian musical sounds with a very modern hip-hop beat. So that was great too, because all of that is only possible because of technology and the ability we have to share that. Something like 37 or 38 million people around the world in under a year have gotten involved with the campaign. They shared their own pictures. They shared their stories. They commented and voted and got involved in these other things. And they had to choose to do it. Amsterdam, both culturally as a creative center, as a commercial center for hundreds of years, but also as a digital center, as a place where in mobile, in internet, in all of the related skill sets and technologies that are part of that, is literally a new hub for that kind of activity.
That was Monocle reporter Louise Stoddard in Amsterdam. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. And we're heading for a short break now, but stay tuned. We're heading back to Eindhoven after that. Welcome back to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Now, the third of our Design Academy Eindhoven graduates, Wouter Streetman, decided to go back to basics with the espresso machine. Our reporter, Emil Elgersma, visited him to discuss his machine and design philosophy over a lovely hand-pressed coffee.
I cannot say what a good espresso is. For me, it's a search to find this really perfect espresso, but it will always change. It is never the same because the coffee bean is a product of nature. My name is Wouter Streetman, and my project is called Espresso Streetman. That's also my company. I graduated from the Design Academy in 2011. At the department Men and Leisure.
So could you make me a nice espresso?
Yeah, of course. How it works is I have this lever arm, and when I put this to the top, the water starts to stream.
Yeah.
Where I do the coffee in here. And then this is the filter basket, of course, and then I lock it in the machine. And then I put the lever to the top, and then the water starts to stream into the sort of extraction chamber. Well, and I have my glass underneath. And when I start pushing, you see, well, here you see the espresso appear. And so you're extracting your own espresso, very manual espresso. So you're actually, you are the one who is extracting, who is applying the pressure. So there's a lot of factors you can influence, and you have all the control, actually, which is very important to have a sort of interaction with technique and with the thing you're extracting.
What I see two cylinders, one in the back with water in it, and then this is a copper, a smaller one, where in the end the espresso comes from.
Yeah, it's from copper, because it holds a lot of heat, copper. So you have a very stable temperature when you're extracting an espresso, for instance. And I use stainless steel for a boiler, because it's easily to maintain, to keep it clean.
The design looks very industrial. You didn't hide anything. It's all visible.
No, it's very naked, very pure. And it's purely form follows function, actually. A very old idea, but I think it's very important also. Yeah, for me, the most important thing is that mostly espresso machines nowadays are sort of all boxed in. The technique, you don't see the technique anymore, and I wanted to show this technique, actually, and give an insight how it works, so that you can also keep this machine functioning for like 40 years, for instance.
That was Monocle reporter Emil Elgersma with Design Academy Eindhoven graduate Wouter Streetman. Next, on our whirlwind tour of the Dutch design industry, we headed over to the art desk at Monocle. Our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, is a fan of Dutch graphics. And from one fan to another, he sat down with Tony Brook, founder of Spin Design Studio, to talk us through the influence Dutch graphic design has had on the world.
I approached the Design Museum with an idea for a Crowell exhibition. And they were very interested, and, you know, they asked me to put a proposal together, which I did. They ended up coming around my house as like a complete Crowell shrine.
Right, okay.
You know, there's sort of literally, I must have 30 or 40 posters on my walls around my house. So we did a kind of a mini walk around an imaginary exhibition at my house.
Right.
And they went for it. They thought it was a great idea, and they were incredibly supportive and helpful, and they made it happen, really. But it was fantastic. I mean, the thing that I probably enjoyed most about it was the visit to the Stedelijk Museum and going through Wim's archive with Wim.
Yeah.
And hearing all the stories and, you know, getting a real inside feel for it was fantastic. And opening up all those kind of archive boxes.
Yeah.
And never knowing quite what was going to be in them. Discovering, like, things that just looked like they'd been delivered from the printer that day that, you know, had never seen the light of day. It was really wonderful. For me, particularly, I find him incredibly inspiring because of his kind of experimental nature and the clarity of his thinking, which I think is something that kind of transcends time, that kind of innovative, you know, kind of personality that he has. But also, I think that technically his grid-based approach is something that you can really see affecting, you know, digital design.
Yeah.
Website design and things like that. In many ways, he was always predicting the computer and predicting the technology and was really interested in technology. And he works on a Mac now, and he's embraced it. So,
what's surprising, I think, about his work, or perhaps not now, and you know, you mentioned his use of grids, but obviously that era of Dutch design predates Apple Mac. It predates Adobe computers. Technology and computers. Yeah. Yeah. And yet half of it, or almost all of it, looks like it's been made on a computer. I mean, it seemed that back then you needed to be as good at design as you did at trigonometry, because lots of these logos and fonts, that they're made up of sectors and quadrants and, you know, squares and grids and circles. And it's interesting that that is how you see, you know, if you understand how computers work, you can look at a logo or a typeface, and you can see how it's been made, you can see what's sort of behind the typeface. But it's interesting that was how he was working, you know, 20, 30 years before that was actually kind of commonplace within design, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely. Müller-Brockmann influenced him, and the Swiss thing influenced him. You know, the whole Swiss movement influenced him, which it would pretty much any graphic designer anywhere. It was a great golden period for the Swiss. But he took it somewhere else, you know. And I think that's partly due to the fact that he was trained as a painter, and he was developing kind of abstract paintings. And I think that helped him enormously. And I also think that, you know, the Dutch are in this wonderful position where they're influenced by all these other countries but have a very strong opinion themselves. So he was never going to just regurgitate the Swiss model or, you know, and you'll still find that today, that the Dutch have got this very particular kind of approach to design, which is very individualistic.
When I look at the two styles, when I look at Swiss graphic design of the 50s and Dutch graphic design of the 60s and 70s, Swiss seems very grey, and the Dutch just seems like an explosion of colour and playfulness, and it just, there's a funness in there that didn't seem to occur in the Swiss.
Well, I mean, it's experimentation. You know, I'd argue that we're probably the worst at following these isms, you know, that like the modernism. We're not very good at following these great trends in the UK for whatever reason. And the Dutch have a wonderful way of perverting them. So I would say that Wim sees himself absolutely as a modernist and is beholden to De Stijl and the Bauhaus and what have you. But as, I think it was Danny from Experimental Jet Set, we were having a chat about it, and he said, well, look at what he does, not what he says. Because what he does is, you know, he uses fluorescent colours, he uses silvers, he's a man of his time. And to be honest, Wim now admits that that's the case, he's a man of his time. But it's got this wonderful sense of playfulness within these rigid structures. It's experimental.
Yeah.
If there's anything that anybody can take away from the Wim Kraal exhibition, I would hope that it would be that they should be finding their own voice and making their own mark.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And just moving slightly further afield, I mean, you mentioned Experimental Jet Set there. And let's just look at a little bit more about Dutch design and perhaps a little bit about Total Design and Kraal's agency, which he started with Ben Bos, I believe, and among others. And I know, again, this is a subject you're quite close to, as you produced a book on this.
Yeah. Well, Total Design was founded by Wim Kraal, Friso Kramer, and a fantastic graphic designer called Benno Wissing, who's someone that people don't really know that much about. Certainly over here, he's absolutely a wonderful designer, as is Friso Kramer. Friso Kramer was designing furniture, got a lovely Friso Kramer table at home. They were set up or financed by these brothers, Swartz brothers, with a specific response to the fact that KLM hadn't been designed by Dutch designers. And the reason for that was that there wasn't a studio that was really capable of doing it at that time. They were all individuals, and it was very much from a painterly poster perspective. So they set up this studio very deliberately as a way of creating an international studio, which, you know, it could have failed miserably, but the fact is that they had these incredible designers right from the off. And, you know, as far as their influence is concerned, it's in Holland, they pretty much created the whole landscape, the whole corporate landscape, certainly. It's funny, when I was walking around the Design Museum, I did a couple of tours around the Design Museum with people, and there was one Dutch guy who was in tears. It was like his whole kind of visual world in one room.
Yeah.
You know, that he'd grown up with throughout his life. And he'd no idea that it was all done by this company.
Yeah.
So it was a real shock for him. Yeah, they pretty much designed Holland in the 60s and 70s.
It's fascinating set of circumstances all around Holland. Everyone is faced with great, great graphic design. I think it must be marvellous place to grow up if you're interested in type, in colour, in shape and branding.
Well, absolutely. Well, they support it. You know, it's integral to the, you know, it's an important part of their culture, as is painting, as are all the other arts. You know, they've got some wonderful designers in all aspects of design and art, but they see graphic design as an equal.
That was Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, with Tony Brook of Spin. in Studio 2 here of Midori House. We're going for a very short break right now, but stay tuned. We're heading to Eindhoven next to hear from our fourth and final graduate about traffic lights.
Every month, Monocle deploys over 70 writers and photographers to over 50 countries to deliver our print edition. Covering a unique mix of global affairs, business, culture and design, Monocle publishes 10 magazine editions a year and 2 special newspapers during the summer and winter holiday seasons. With a subscription to Monocle, you'll not only be the first to receive the magazine, you'll also be invited to special events and receive our iconic tote bag from Rutote of Japan. Subscribe to Monocle from £80 sterling at our website at shop.monocle.com/subscriptions. Subscribe to Monocle and keep an eye on the world.
Welcome back to Section D, D for Dutch, here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. It's time for our final Eindhoven student check-in. It's the turn now of Dennis van Melick. Our reporter, Emil Elgersma, visited his office in Eindhoven to hear how he's reimagined the traffic light.
I travelled around the city and I came by 22 different traffic lights, and in my eyes they were all the same. So why didn't we innovate after 30 years on traffic regulation systems? I'm Dennis van Melick, 25 years old. I studied at the Design Academy, Man and Mobility. My graduation project was the 3-to-1 traffic light.
And could you explain what it is?
Nowadays, all traffic lights have those 3 lights above each other. This one has only 1 display. It's a panel made up of 3 kinds of LEDs, red, green and blue LEDs, that have the function to show every shape and color.
And that's instead of a traffic light?
For instance, green is a circle, orange is a triangle, and red is a square. It's communicating more. So, for instance, there's an fire truck coming behind you, and it's communicating that you have to move out of the way. So we have functionalities all over, and it is so flexible that we can provide every information in graphic and in symbolism to the road user.
And you're actually using information that's already there?
It's just plug and play with the main cabinets that are along the crossings. We can already display these features. For instance, the radio wave system, we already know it from buses.
Why didn't anybody think of this before?
It's all regulated by a lot of laws, so it's very difficult to make a change. I made this change possible by really having a discussion with the people who are standardizing these laws.
What did they say?
They were really open-minded. They also knew that it was time to innovate on this particular product.
That was our dogged reporter Emil Elgersma in Eindhoven with student Dennis van Melick. Now, the recent batch of graduates we've profiled here are all setting foot in the big bad world, away from the cosy confines of school. To reassure them that life can still be very good, we dropped in on one very successful graduate, Philippe Malouin. We sent our reporter, Lolita Laguna, to his London studio to talk to him about his time at the Academy and the influence it's had over his career.
There's a space where everyday functional design meets conceptual art. Sitting in that space is designer Philippe Malouin. Born in Canada, he is now based in his London studio, where he creates pieces bound for galleries in cities such as Milan and Beirut. After an educational circuit that took him through the University of Montreal and Lancy Les Ateliers in Paris, it was on an internship at an Amsterdam-based design agency where he was first persuaded to apply to the Design Academy Eindhoven.
When I sort of expressed that
I wasn't quite ready to go back to Canada and that I wanted to stay in Europe, my then boss, Frank Chepkema, told me you should go to Eindhoven. And Eindhoven, as a Canadian from Montreal, always seemed like this impossible to get into school that, you know, you had to be a superstar to get in. And he's like, no, don't be silly. Just go and meet this person and bring your work and bring some of the work you've done for me here. And I met someone called Bas Van Tol, and he reviewed my portfolio and he gave me a chance. And I stayed there for my two last years of design education and graduated.
The Academy's reputation is globally renowned, and this reputation impressed Philippe from the start.
Already, as I was in University of Montreal, I remember some teachers at Design Academy Eindhoven were, you know, already acclaimed designers, and even the graduate work was heavily cataloged, which is, you know, a part of the school as well. The communication of Design Academy Eindhoven is sheer genius. I mean, their graduates, right as they graduated, are, you know, in the international press. I guess it made it extremely professional and very, very foreign from the type of education I was currently undergoing and living. I was very impressed by it. So, you know, it seemed like a big deal to me. And it was a very big deal. And I was lucky enough to get in.
It was a cultural shock to go from Amsterdam to the smaller city of Eindhoven. But Philippe was comforted by the number of foreign students attending the academy.
Dutch people are wonderful just because everybody speaks perfect, eloquent English, which is amazing for international relations and education. Therefore, it attracts such an international sort of crowd. So, and just the style or how design was approached as an art form was completely different, because my original training was strict industrial design that is not meant to be art-based, oriented, or borrowed from. And that was a big difference.
Are there any specific moments that you can recall, either in a class or a conversation with a professor, that you can link really directly to what you're doing now or influences what you're doing now?
I think I was told by quite a strict, very scientific-based teacher that concept was very fun, but you had to be able to use it. You know, I wanted to be very conceptual because that's what I thought I needed to do at the time in Eindhoven. And it was good. It was good advice. I think concept is extremely important, but it needs substance in order to sort of stand the test of time, and it can't just be solely crazy. When I went to Eindhoven, it was great because I was under the direction of Lee Edelcourt. And Lee Edelcourt had a very strong vision, which I'm very thankful for, because the vision of design when I went there was that it was very process-based design education, which means that process is more important than what it looks like. What it looks like is still important, but it comes at the end of the design process. Process-based design is just basically learning and finding new ways of manufacturing and doing, which in its own sort of existence created new objects. I learned to not do what I originally learned for designing, which is, you know, what it looks like isn't the most important thing. How it came to life before it was actually drawn on a piece of paper is much more important and interesting, because it has a story. Much more of a story than just drawing it. The Dutch influence, especially during, you know, the early 2000s and late 90s, was just so revolutionary and just pushed all of us to see design from a completely inaccessible sort of entity to more of an engaging, playful experience.
It's not just that experience and education that has value. There is, of course, also the distinction of simply being a graduate.
I suppose it's a form of branding of a designer. It just gives you this, no, I wouldn't say immediate, because it would be silly to immediately think that a new graduate is a full-fledged designer, and you know, or even 10 years later. But I think it facilitated communication of your work greatly. I was lucky enough to be chosen and showed in Milan with other students and, you know, people from the press and people from galleries and people from different walks of the design sort of world paid attention to my work. And I started to work on my own as my own designer. So it all happened very, very quickly. I suppose what it does is it just accelerates things to a degree that's kind of hard to deal with, just because the amount of press that happens, the amount of press kits and photo requests and all these things that you never think would ever happen to you, and it just kind of did. And now I'm working full time, and I have a studio and lovely employees and people that work with me, and they're extremely talented. And I think I owe it greatly to, you know, Design Academy Eindhoven and especially Lee Edelcourt, who gave us a big chance, and very thankful for that. It's a very different place, and it's very interesting to hear the story they have to tell. I know it sounds corny, but a lot of the work and the graduates is, there's so much research that goes into what the product actually means to us and what it, why the product should exist in the first place. And I think it's a non-capitalist direct approach to mass manufacturing, which is something that's very commendable.
That was Monocle reporter Lalita Laguna with designer Philip Malouin in his London studio. And I'm afraid that's all we've got time for on this week's episode. But fear not, we'll be back next week with a thrillingly festive Section D. Tune in to hear what goes on behind the doors of the Lego factory in Denmark, how the best Christmas windows around the world are put together, and what our designers want to find under their trees. All that and much, much more to look forward to next week. But for now, it's goodbye. This episode of Section D was produced by Gillian Tobias. Our researchers were Taya Erdl and Hazel Pfeiffer. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening. We're going to be playing you out with a fittingly Dutch song. This is Amsterdam by Wouter Hamel.
When the night is falling, when the long day's through, I'll see the one I used to love again. When the night is falling, I'll wear my favorite shoes, forget about the pictures in the news. When the night is falling, stage. When the night is falling, I'll finally turn the page. I'll be here in the darkness, won't keep you to myself. See the one I used to love again. I'll be here in the darkness. I'll wear my favorite shirt. Forget about the places where it hurts. Over Amsterdam.